This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our guest Robert Whitman spent 20 years as an FBI agent. He did plenty of undercover work, wearing body wires and meeting criminals in hotel rooms with suitcases of cash. But Whitman wasn't usually buying drugs or guns in his sting operations. He was more often looking for a Rembrandt or a headdress worn by the Apache warrior Geronimo. Whitman specialized in stolen art and antiquities, and his efforts were aimed as much at recovering the stolen treasure as catching the thieves. Whitman founded the FBI's Art Crime Team, and by the Bureau's accounting, he saved hundreds of millions of dollars worth of art and antiquities. His memoir with writer John Schiffman is called Priceless: How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. It's now out in paperback. I spoke to Robert Whitman last year when the hardback edition was published. Well, Robert Whitman, welcome to Fresh Air. I thought we'd begin by giving the audience a taste of what your life was like for years working for the FBI on recovering stolen art and antiquities. And I thought maybe you'd tell us a bit about recovering a Rembrandt from a heist from a Swedish museum, that a robbery that took place in 2000. It's such an interesting heist. Just tell us about the robbery itself first.
Well, that was an interesting robbery. It occurred in December, late December of the year 2000, as you said. And what happened there, three individuals went into the Swedish National Museum in Stockholm. They had machine guns. They put everybody on the floor, the guards, the few visitors that were there. And remember, it's late in December. It's around 5 o'clock. It's near Christmas time. Very dark at that point in Sweden. At the same time, their compatriots set off two car bombs on the two main roads leading to the museum, which is on a small peninsula right on the water. So there's really no way to get there except those two roads. The reason for that was to stop the police from responding quickly. So they had about 40 minutes before the police could get there. So the car bombs go off. They put everybody on the floor. They continue that at that point to run through the museum. They stole two Renoir paintings and a Rembrandt. And the Rembrandt was probably one of the finest pieces in the museum. It's a self-portrait. It's done on copper. And it's the only one that was ever done by Rembrandt on copper. It was done in 1630 when Rembrandt was at the age of 24 years old. He actually used gold in the paints to make it iridescent, to make it luminescent so it glows at you when you look at it. But they stole that piece as well. The total value of that heist was $42 million. At that point, then they made their way out of the museum. And as I said, it's on a peninsula right on the water in a harbor there in Stockholm. And they made their getaway in a high-speed boat.
Right. So the cops are all trying to get through this traffic jam caused by cars. And away they get on the water.
Away. Absolutely. It was a very, very good a good scripted robbery. But as I often say, you know, many times in these cases, the thieves are very good art thieves, but they're terrible businessmen. Because it took them 5 years to try to sell the paintings. And at no point did they ever make any money. In the end, we ended up catching them, and it's because they were trying to sell the Renoir and the Rembrandt for very little money compared to what the value was.
Right. Not easy to move a piece of art like that. I wanted to also talk about the moment at which you catch these guys, because you worked undercover, very often posing as a crooked art dealer or someone representing a crooked art dealer. You're the one that's going to give them a briefcase full of cash in return for the stolen art. And it often comes down, as it did in this case, in a hotel room. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, sometimes that's the way it works. Sometimes we would work a cash for paintings deal. In this particular case, we developed an informant who was out in L.A., and we worked with the Los Angeles FBI, who did a great job on the case. We ended up going to Stockholm and also to Copenhagen to work that case. And I was undercover at that point as an authenticator for an Eastern European mob group. After about 2 weeks of discussions with the thieves who were still in Stockholm, and again, we were in Copenhagen, about a six-hour train ride away, we negotiated the point down to about $250,000. And we actually had $250,000 in cash in the hotel room, and we were bringing them back and forth to let them see it, to make sure they know it was real. So at the very last end, the last day, I told the thieves, come down tomorrow, bring one person, bring the painting, we'll make the deal. At that point, the next morning, we found out from our surveillance teams in Sweden that three individuals were coming down on the train. They took the ride down, and they had a bag. And inside the bag was a square object the size of the painting. They asked me, should we take this down now? Should we arrest them? I said, no. I said, hold off, wait, see what happens. After the six-hour ride, they came to walk to the hotel. Two people stayed outside with the bag. and the third individual came back in to see me.
Now, if I can just get into the story at this point, you're in there on your own. I assume you are unarmed, right?
Right.
But there is secret videotaping going on.
Absolutely.
You're dealing with criminals. You don't know what they might do. They might kill you and take the cash. Where's your backup?
We had a Danish SWAT team in a room next door, and they were ready to go upon my signal through a video camera. They would come into the room and make the arrest. But you know, one thing we always did in the FBI, something we always said in the undercover unit was your backup team was there to avenge you, but not to save you. Because by the time backup teams get into those situations, usually it takes too long. And it's not like the movies where, if something bad's going to happen, the bad guy stands there and points his gun at you and stands there and tells you about it for about 20 minutes. No, if it happens, it happens very quickly, because that's how it goes.
And in this particular case, you went through a run-through to make sure everything was set, and
that's
you discovered
right.
a snag.
Yeah, well, right when they were coming into the hotel, I checked the key to the room that the SWAT team had, and the key didn't work. So I had to run downstairs very quickly. And, with all the support that you have and the dozens of undercover agents that are outside and all the SWAT teams and everything, in the end, it always comes down to the one guy in the room. So I checked the
so
door.
So one of these
again.
Little magnetic keys.
The key, right. Didn't open the door.
And the SWAT guy's key would not have worked.
That's right.
You would have been there on your own
exactly.
if you hadn't checked.
If I hadn't checked. So I went down and got a new key, came back and handed it off to them and went back into the room. At which point, the individual came up. He wanted to look at the money. He did look at the money. He said it was good. So I said, go get it. Go get the painting and bring it to me. We'll do this deal. He goes outside. He gets his two friends and they run away. And I get a call from the Danish police, and they say, well, what happened? What did you say? And I said, I don't know. I said, I didn't say anything. I can't understand why they would run. And they said, well, do you want me to arrest them? I said, no. Hold up again. See what happens. Well, what they did was they went to another hotel. They got a fourth individual who had come down the night before, and he had the painting. So the bag that they carried was nothing but a decoy. Had we taken an arrest at that point with that bag, we would have had nothing. But they got the fourth person, they got the bag, and they came back, and that's when they brought it to my room. And at that point, we were able to recover that $36 million Rembrandt, which was, as I say, it was probably the finest piece in the museum.
Right. And you, since you're the phony authenticator,
right.
you take the painting into the bathroom and said, let me look at it real carefully. And then the signal for the SWAT team to come in was what?
Well, basically, it was this is a done deal. And so what I would normally do in these cases is take the painting into usually a dark room. And a safe room. And if you think about it, the only place in a hotel room that's really relatively safe with a lock is the bathroom. So I would take it in the bathroom, take a look at it, make sure it was right. In this case, I'd had a chance to look at the back of the painting through pictures. And I noticed that the clips holding the painting into the frame were at a certain angle. So at that point, I looked at the painting itself and noticed that the clips were at the same angle. So I could tell he had never taken it out of the frame. So I mentioned to him, I said, This you've never even taken this out of the frame, have you? And he looked at me and he says, of course not. It's a Rembrandt. So he showed me some respect for the actual artwork itself. At that point, I made the signal. I went to the door. I had the painting in my hands and right at the bathroom door. And I looked over and they were having a hard time getting into the room. The SWAT team, yeah. It seemed like they couldn't get the door open. So I started to reach for the door to try to open it for them, okay, while the bad guys had their back to me. And at that point, I guess the key did work because they did make it in, and I immediately bolted out with the painting.
And the signal was, we got a done deal.
We've got a done deal, that's right.
And you've been in this situation so many times where people that you have befriended over many months, suddenly armed men burst into the room and they realize that
yeah.
that you are indeed a cop and they have been had. What kind of interactions occur between you and the crooks at that point?
Well, at that point, my feelings are one of, relief that it's over, okay, because we've finally gotten the peace back that we wanted. But in some cases, it's actually interesting because in some cases, there's a feeling of being let down as well, all right? And that is because when you work undercover and you do a good job, all right, you have to identify traits in people in your targets and whatnot that are human. If you don't do that, then you can never ingratiate them. You can't become friends with a person that you can't stand. So sometimes in those cases, you see the good sides of people as well as the bad. And as a result, you can identify with some of those good traits that they have. And, when you see them get in trouble and their families are going to suffer, then you feel a little bit of pity in that situation. And you have to live with that.
If you're just joining us, our guest is former FBI agent Robert Whitman. He's written a book about his years recovering stolen art and antiquities. It's called Priceless: How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. The FBI didn't have a stolen art unit before you got into their lives.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about your own knowledge and affection for art.
Well, you know, what happened was I never really thought I'd be involved in the art and artifacts division of the FBI, if there was one. I didn't even know there was one at the time, and there isn't. We started it in 2005. But when I joined the FBI in 1988, I had grown up in a household where my dad was an Oriental antiques dealer, and he would sell Japanese and Chinese artifacts. Not artifacts, but art. And I grew up in Baltimore. He had a shop on Howard Street, and we would, you know, we would work together occasionally on Saturdays, and I would help him in his shop as he got older. So I got my background in the business of art, which is totally different from art history. The business of art and how to buy and sell art has nothing to do with art history. Okay, it's all about how to make a deal. And so when I came in the FBI, the first case I was assigned, along with my new partner Bob Bazin, who was the art guy in Philadelphia, was a theft from the Rodin Museum. And he and I worked together on that. Once we solved that particular robbery, we were actually given another one, which was a theft of a large crystal ball, which was owned by the Dowager Empress of China. And that was stolen from the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. So we recovered that as well. After that happened, the Bureau sent me to art school at the Barnes Foundation. And I did a year of actual art history and that recognition of art. And then they sent me to the GIA in Santa Monica for Gemological Institute of America for Diamond School, and then to Zales Corporation in Dallas for gemology. And once they send you to all these schools, you got to start using that technique, that knowledge. And that's why I got into the art and antiques.
And so you could sometimes come off to a criminal as someone who was an art appraiser, for example.
Well, sometimes usually a dealer. Mm-hmm. Sometimes an authenticator, depending on the specific type of artifacts I was looking at. But again, the real knowledge that really helped me was the knowledge of the art business. Because, you know, when I did a case, say I did a case in Santa Fe for 6 months. I was undercover there buying Native American Indian artifacts that were illegal. And I didn't have to know a whole lot about that. But I did have to know how to make a deal. All right. And so what I convinced the dealers I was working with, they call them the Santa Fe Mafia in some circles, because there is a $50 million Native American business there in artifacts that are illegal. And what I convinced them was that I was representing buyers from around the world who are interested in buying these artifacts. But I wasn't real knowledgeable, so I needed their help to make sure we got the best material for these buyers.
And you got this guy to give you, what was it, a Comanche headdress?
Yeah, at one point we did get a Comanche war bonnet made of eagle feathers with a number of different types of decorations on it that were illegal. And, when we get into the Native American artifacts and these sacred items, these pieces are very valuable to the communities that they represent. And it was an amazing education.
Let's talk about one of the cases that you solved and that you write about in the book. A couple of items taken from the Antiquities Museum at the University of Pennsylvania. One Egyptian, one Chinese. Tell us about what was missing.
Yeah, the Chinese piece was a wonderful crystal ball. It's the second largest crystal ball in the world. The only one that's bigger is at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. This particular one weighed more than 50 pounds. It's a perfect crystal, perfectly round sphere. It took 10 years to create, okay, in a tube with water and emery powder. And it was turned constantly to make this sphere. And as I say, it was owned by the Dowager Empress of China and was collected in the early 1900s by the University of Pennsylvania. That particular piece and also a statue of the god Osiris, which is the god of the dead, were stolen together.
And that was an Egyptian piece, right?
Yeah. That was an Egyptian piece, yeah, from 3500 B.C. So we're talking about this piece of the crystal ball and the god Osiris being stolen together at one point. And, we had no clues for about 2 years.
Did they simply open the museum one day and find them missing?
Well, we never did catch the actual thieves themselves, but we did recover the items. My assumption, this is my opinion, I don't know for a fact, but they were doing a lot of construction at the museum at the time. And I know that some of the workers were going outside the museum taking a cigarette break during the day, and they would leave the door open, all right? And that's how the intruders got in, stole the pieces. Well, the next morning, we found the what they call the wave, which is what the crystal ball would sit on. It's a silver sculpture that the crystal ball sat on. It was on one of the pylons on the South Street Bridge. It was just sitting there. So obviously, they couldn't carry all this stuff. The Osiris was too heavy, along with the crystal ball, to carry at one time. It took us about 2 years. Finally, we cracked the case. What happened was one of the workers at the museum went to a secondhand shop, and she's walking through, just rummaging through, and she looks in the back, and there is the god Osiris, and she sees it.
Just a coincidence. A museum worker says, hey, wait a minute.
That's exactly right. She had been there. She's a volunteer. She knew the place, and it was a $15,000 reward offered as well. So she went back to the museum, you know, excitedly, and told the director. They went down to the antique shop, and they made the claim, of course, that that was the god Osiris. The piece was worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, it's a 5,000-year-old statue. So we got, my partner Bob Bazin again and I, we went into the shop. We found out where this piece was being had been bought from. And it was bought from a picker who was going around, walking around the area with a shopping cart, picking trash. And that's what he did. We found him, interviewed him, and we found out which house it came from. We went to the house, and there was an individual there. And we knocked on the door, and we said, sir, you know, we're here to talk to you about the god Osiris that you gave to the picker. And he says, yeah, about 2 years ago, I found it in my mud room just sitting there.
My mud room. What does he mean by that?
Well, he had like a little mud room outside
an entryway where you knock mud off
exactly,
your feet.
Exactly, into the back of his house, and which was set on the side on South Street. So we said, well, did you find anything else? And he said, well, there was this lawn ball. He called it a lawn ball. And my partner and I said, you mean like a crystal ball? And he said, yeah, exactly. And I said, well, what did you do with it? And I'm hoping he didn't throw it away. You know, I was just terrified that he threw it away. And he says, well, I gave it to my housekeeper. And we said, well, why would you do that? And he said, well, because she's a witch. And she needed a crystal ball. So we said, okay, this is great. Call your housekeeper, find out if she still has it. It turned out she lived up in Trenton, New Jersey. So at that point, my partner and I, we ran up to Trenton, New Jersey. We knocked on the door, and she still had the piece. And we went in, and she said, well, yeah, we have it upstairs. So she takes us upstairs into her bedroom. And there's a young lady with blonde hair, very pretty. And she said, and here it is. And right on her dresser, the crystal ball was sitting on a little stand with a baseball cap on it. Now, we're talking about, you know, the Dowager Empress of China's crystal ball from the 1800s, worth maybe $350,000 at the time, sitting on this young girl's dresser with a baseball cap on it. She had no clue, you know, what it was.
And so in that case, no reason to doubt the good faith of anybody you talk to, right?
Not those individuals.
No criminal charges in this case.
Not those individuals. No, we basically could not prove that anyone had any criminal liability at that point because they didn't know what they had. They didn't even know what the crystal ball was.
You have to tell the story about the time the diamond buyer was involved and you were going to meet him at a hotel.
There was a situation where an individual went into a jeweler and what he wanted to do, he wanted to buy diamonds. And he was trying to tell the jeweler that he was working for the CIA and that he was paying his informants in diamonds, with diamonds in Europe. So, of course, the jeweler became suspicious, and he showed him checks worth $15 million. He wanted to buy millions of dollars worth of loose diamonds. So the jeweler called us at the FBI and said, you know, this is the situation. What's the deal? And, of course, as soon as we heard that, you know, CIA agents don't carry identification. They don't have badges that say CIA on them, which is what this guy was showing. So we said, look, make the deal, and we'll go do the delivery. So at that point, we waited a weekend, and that Monday, I was the one who was going to deliver these $15 million worth of loose diamonds in a satchel, briefcase. And while I was discussing that with the individual, he was asking me, are you going to have that, you know, handcuffed to your arm? And I said, yeah, that's how we usually carry them. Well, I'll have these the satchel handcuffed to my arm so it's for safety and security. And he said, okay. So we went up, met him in a hotel in Philadelphia. And I met him in the lobby, and he comes down. And it was strange. He was coming down from his room, and he came up to the elevator, and he had a heavy coat on.
And the plan was you were then going to go up to
the
room
we weren't
to make
go
the
out.
Exchange.
We right? weren't supposed to go outside at all. He just comes down the elevator from his room with a heavy coat on. That was very suspicious right off the bat. So we spoke for a little while, and I noticed he was starting to perspire, but he wouldn't take his coat off. So then when he suggested we go to the room now and go make the deal, I said, okay. So we started walking towards the elevator, and at that point I called in the SWAT team that were sitting around reading papers and whatnot in the lobby. And when he was arrested, he actually had a pistol, which is we expected, but he also had a hatchet. And the plan was to cut off my arm up in the room and then grab the satchel and jump out the window and jump into his car, which was parked right underneath the window. And he had left a whole bag full of bandages there as well in case he got hurt. so he could bandage himself up. So it was pretty interesting. I guess he had some pretty nefarious ideas in his mind when he was going to do that deal.
So pretty clear after this came down that you could see that, he planned your murder and dismemberment.
Well, I would think so. I would hope he'd kill me before he cut my arm off. I don't know. But, you know, those things happen.
Well, Robert Whitman, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Robert Whitman's memoir is called Priceless: How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. It's now out in paperback. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. Our guest, the Spanish actor Javier Bardem, won an Oscar for his performance as a psychopathic killer in the 2007 Coen Brothers film No Country for Old Men. He played a seductive Spanish artist in the Woody Allen film Vicky Cristina Barcelona. Bardem has been a respected actor in international cinema for years. He earned 7 nominations for the Goya, known as the Spanish Oscars, and he's won 4 times. His films include Live Flesh, Before Night Falls, and The Sea Inside. He earned his 3rd Academy Award nomination earlier this year for his performance in the film Beautiful by Mexican director Alejandro González Iñárritu. It was nominated for Best Foreign Language Film. It's now out on DVD. In Beautiful, Bardem plays a small-time criminal in Barcelona who runs a crew of African immigrants selling knockoff goods on the street. He also has connections to a sweatshop of illegal Chinese immigrants. But he's a loving and attentive father to his 2 children. Their mother, his wife, suffers from bipolar disorder. And on top of it all, he learns he has a life-threatening illness. I spoke to Javier Bardem earlier this year and asked him about playing the lead character in Beautiful.
It was very challenging, and I was scared to death to do it. But I thought it was going to be a very rewarding experience, which it was. Not only at a professional level, but also at personal level.
Yeah, and why at a personal level?
Because you have to face yourself. It's impossible to do a character like this from the outside. It's impossible to be 5 months, almost 12 to 14 hours per day, 6 days per week, submerged in this emotional state and not be affected. When you are portraying somebody and that has a very, a very specific weight, emotional weight, you feel like you're starting to really, to abandon your own body and go to someplace else. And then when you come back to yourself, people that know you well, family and friends, they know. It's like, why do you say that? Or why are you doing this? Or why are you behaving this way? You are not like that. But you, yourself, you don't realize because he's so unconscious that you don't have control over it.
Now, to the director, the Mexican, Alejandro González Iñárritu, I know that you and he were friends before this, and he wrote this part with you in mind in part. And he describes himself as a perfectionist. And this is hard to believe, but I read the scene in which you talk to your doctor and your doctor informs you that you have cancer, your character. I read that you took 50 takes of that scene. Is that right?
I don't know if 50, but a lot. He likes to shoot and shoot and shoot. And which that explains why he's, I would say he's the best actor, director I ever met. And why is that? Well, besides shooting 50 takes, which is very exhausting for everybody, it's about putting the camera in the right way, in the right place, at the right moment, and letting the actor breathe, and letting the actor to take the time to take the journey. We both go to a place where we want to give the best of ourselves, and that's why we went through this journey together until the very end.
A lot of people saw you in Vicky Cristina Barcelona, a romantic comedy in which Barcelona looks just terrific. I mean, the sun shines and the scenery is beautiful and the sea is glistening. In this film, Beautiful, there's a very different side of Barcelona. Do you want to describe a little bit some of the neighborhoods that this takes place in?
Yes. This Barcelona is more the Barcelona of people and communities that are full of people that are coming from outside of Spain. It's more of a landscape of immigration. And it's around the, in the exterior neighborhoods, out of the town. But also, in the middle of the town, there are many places where you can walk through these major and very famous shops. And two doors down the street, there is a big building full of, I don't know, people that are trying to survive there. But basically, most of it happens out of the Barcelona that we know, which is the Barcelona that it was portrayed in Woody Allen's movie, which, by the way, is a beautiful Barcelona. But as any other town in the world, it has two faces.
Well, we have to talk about No Country for Old Men, the Coen brothers film, where you play Anton Chigurh, this truly scary sociopathic killer. First of all, just explain how you got the look of this guy.
Well, Tommy Lee Jones brought a book, a photo book, of photos that were taken in the frontier with No Mexico. And there was this guy who was in the photo. It was a kind of a black and white photo with a prostitute in a brothel in the frontier. And Joel and Ethan Coen brought that picture to me and they said, we want this. And the photo actually was very blurry. And I said, I don't know what you mean. I said, you'll know. You'll know soon. So they put me in the hair, in the makeup and hair trailer. And the hairdresser, which is a great, great man, he did this horrible haircut on my hair, with my hair. And there was no mirror. So I turned and I look at them and they were laughing so hard that one of them fell off on the floor. Ha, 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 ha. And I said, I need a mirror. I need a mirror right now. What's going on here? And I saw it and it was like, wow, that's really insane. But again, it's Coen Brothers. It's so brilliant idea. I mean, it's so brilliant. I mean, I knew that they give me 50% of my character with that haircut. It was their idea.
Right. And for people who haven't seen it, it's you have long hair. It's not particularly stylish. A.O. Scott of the New York Times called it the lost beetle from hell.
that's a good one.
Right. So let's hear just a little bit of you in this character. We have a clip here from the film. And for those who haven't seen it, the plot involves there was a bunch of drug dealers and there was a shootout. And this guy who happens to be a welder, who's played by Josh Brolin, comes upon a satchel full of drug money and is running. And your character, Anton Chigurh, is trying to track him down. And what we're going to listen to is a phone call between you and this guy who has the money. And one of the things that is referred to in the call is that you know where his wife lives and is headed to Odessa, Texas, and the clear intimation is that, that you will kill his wife if he doesn't bring you the money. So let's just listen to this conversation. This is our guest Javier Bardem and Josh Brolin in No Country for Old Men.
You need to come see me.
Who is this?
You know who it is. You need to talk to me.
I don't need to talk to you.
I think you do. Do you know where I'm going?
Why would I care where you're going?
I know where you are.
Yeah, where am I?
You're in the hospital across the river, but that's not where I'm going. Do you know where I'm going?
Yeah, I know where you're going.
All right.
You know she won't be there.
It doesn't make any difference where she is.
So what are you going up there for?
You know how this is going to turn out, don't you?
Nope.
I think you do. So this is what I'll offer. You bring me the money and I'll let her go. Otherwise, she's accountable. The same as you. That's the best deal you're going to get. I won't tell you you can save yourself, because you can't.
And that's one of the 10 scariest guys I've ever seen in a movie. That's our guest, Javier Bardem, from the film, the Coen Brothers film, No Country for Old Men. You know, your character, Anton Chigurh, we don't really know anything about him in the film. And I gather in the novel, the Cormac McCarthy novel, he's also not so clearly defined. Mm-hmm. Did you have a backstory in your head that told you how he became what he was?
That's a very funny and very interesting question. No, I didn't. And actually, that's one of the things that I love to do the most, to create a story, a backstory in my head that will help me to understand what I'm doing. But in this case, I've prepared the role with my acting teacher, Juan Carlos Coraza, which has been my acting teacher since 22 years ago. And of course, once when I go there with Juan Carlos, with my acting teacher, I go based on the ideas that the Coens want me to do. It's not something that he will direct me how to do it and then I will go to the set and do what I want. No, it's like I talk to the directors, they tell me what they want, I go there to the laboratory, try different things, come back to them, and they choose what they want. And I was working with Juan Carlos, and we found, like, there is no way there's backstory, and that's the great thing. He is not a human being. There is no backstory. He is a symbol. He is a symbolic idea of violence. He is a man that comes out of nowhere and goes to nowhere at the end. So he is death himself. He is violence himself. And that's why we wanted to create this thing where you are not sure what is him, if he's a man or a machine or a biblical plague or what. And that was funny to do, but also very delicate to not transpass the line. And in that, the Coens had a lot to say because they were directing me on the set in a very, very, very subtle way, but also without losing the sense of humor.
Sense of humor, huh?
Yeah. That look, that way of walking, that way of throwing one line here and there, that's something that the Coens were, they were pushing me, not pushing me, like asking me to do. And sometimes I will go like, why, you don't need that, you don't need, why would he do that? And they were laughing. And they said, you'll know when you see the movie.
Can you think of an example of one of those things that you said, why do you want me to do that? And then it made sense later?
I don't know, there's a scene where I go to the trailer park and I ask for Josh Brolin's character and there's this woman there and then I ask where he is and she says, I cannot give any information. And then I naturally look at her and I went away and they said, no, you look at her and you stay there for 2 minutes. And I was like, what? Yes, we want you to look at her and stare at her for 2 minutes. I mean, without blinking. I said, okay, I'll do that. And I thought at the moment it was a little bit too forced, you know, too pushy. But no, they knew exactly. And that's one of the moments where I think and I know people laugh the most with that look. So those are the things that the Coens know how to do the best.
Yeah, I remember that scene too. And she says, sir, we can't give out no information.
Exactly.
You just stare right back at her. You became a really leading actor in Spanish cinema. Did you aspire to act in English then at all?
Well, I'm 42 years old, so I guess my generation, we all grew up with Taxi Driver and Apocalypse Now and great performances done in English, along with some of the great performers also in Italy, France, and of course Spain, which I have the chance to work with some of them. But I never thought about going out of Spain and working in a foreign language ever, because that was totally out of my my radar. No, it's like, no, that's not going to happen. But it happened. That's the weird thing. And if you ask me why, I can tell you. There's this lovely man called Julian Schnabel, which I love and I adore, who had the guts to say, I want you to do Before Night Falls. And everybody around was like, why, who's that guy? Why him? And he said, well, because I like him, because he saw some of my movies in Spain. At that time, I didn't speak any English. And he said, we're going to make this together, don't worry, it's going to be fine. And I have one of the best experiences of my life doing that movie. I will never forget it. And we worked hard and we made it, and I guess that brought some attention.
You really didn't speak English before getting into that movie?
No, I mean, just hello and give me a glass of water. That's all. I'm always saying that I know how to curse very well because I've learned English listening to AC/DC.
Okay.
So I'm a huge fan of AC/DC, and so I was translating the lyrics, so I know how to curse.
You have to start somewhere, right?
Exactly.
Well, we should just pause a minute on this film because it was a real important one for you. Before Night Falls, directed by Julian Schnabel, it's you play the poet and novelist Reynaldo Arena, who was a gay man persecuted in Cuba during the revolution. It kind of takes us through the through the 60s, through the Mariel Boatlift, when you, his character, ends up in New York and gets AIDS. I mean, it's a it's a really dramatic role. And one of the things that's fascinating to me about it is that it takes place in Cuba, but much of the dialogue is in English. How is acting in English different from acting in Spanish for you?
It's a different, it's a totally different situation. And it's like here, I'm trying to express myself and share some opinions and be relaxed. And there is this office in my brain full of people working at the same time that I'm talking to you, trying to not be wrong with the intonation, with the words. So it's very exhausting.
The office is translating, because, right? Okay.
Exactly. If I speak Spanish, that office is closed. There's nobody in the office. I mean, I'm fine but by my own.
You got to work with Woody Allen on Vicky Cristina Barcelona. How did you get that role?
Well, I had a call from Mr. Woody Allen, which I was very impressed by. He told me briefly, I have a script for you, I want you to read it, and he hung up. And I said, okay, whatever. And then I read it, and I thought it was fun, and it was very, very, I don't know, smart, because it's about the stereotypes and the people behind those stereotypes. And then he called me back and said, do you like it? I said, yes, okay, you are on. It was that easy.
So let's listen to a clip. This is a moment early in the film. You play this romantic painter, Juan Antonio, who approaches these two young American women who are in Barcelona, played here by Rebecca Hall and Scarlett Johansson, and make a pretty forward proposal. Let's listen.
American?
I'm Christina, and this is my friend Vicky.
What color are your eyes?
They're blue.
I'd like to invite you both to come with me to Oviedo.
To come where?
To Oviedo. For the weekend. We leave in 1 hour.
What? Where is Oviedo?
A very short flight.
By plane?
Mm-hmm.
What's in Oviedo?
I go to see a sculpture that is very inspiring to me. Very beautiful sculpture. You'll love it.
Oh, right. You're asking us to fly to Oviedo and back?
No, we'll spend the weekend. I mean, I'll show you around the city, and we'll eat well, we'll drink good wine, we'll make love.
Yeah, who exactly is going to make love?
Hopefully the three of us.
Oh, my God.
I'll get your bill.
Jesus, this guy, he doesn't beat around the bush. Look, senor, maybe in a different life.
Why not? Life is short, life is dull, life is full of pain, and this is a chance for something special.
And that's our guest, Javier Bardem, putting moves on Scarlett Johansson and Rebecca Hall in Vicky Cristina Barcelona. You dog. Have you ever done anything like that in real life?
No way. Actually, I was shooting that scene and I said, who in the world is going to believe this? But Woody Allen did it right. I guess some people thought it was funny, and those two girls were crazy enough to do it.
Right, and then off goes romantic triangles, quadrangles, and mm-hmm. pentangles.
I think it's a great movie, and because it's really about, I was saying before, about the stereotypes, about the clichés, the Spanish cliché and the American cliché, actually, and the people behind those clichés, that basically we are all the same, we have the same fears, needs, and the way it's put together, I think it was very fun, but also very poignant, very, very, very... I'm very delightful to watch.
Right, and Penelope Cruz comes in a terrific mm-hmm. performance. Some people probably saw this as an antidote to the Anton Chigurh character, where you're this psychopathic killer in No Country for Old Men. Did you see it that way at all?
Not really. No. I don't have a plan. I don't have a plan in my head. I mean, if things happen, things have a meaning to you, and you do it. And there's no way that you can do a next step based on the previous one. That doesn't work that way, in my opinion. I mean, Woody Allen gave me this call. He showed me this. I thought it was going to be fun and great cast, Barcelona. And I said, well, why not? Let's do it. And once again, Woody Allen was shooting one take. So it's a different experience, for 30 takes to one take. and no rehearsals. So it was kind of jumping off the cliff for me, because the scenes are very long and there's no cut. So it was very challenging and also very rewarding.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how he was different from some of the great international directors you've worked with. That's one way. One take, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, one take and no rehearsal. And I don't know if I ever came to him and said, I would like to speak of my character, but I think I did that, and he looked at me like, I killed someone. Like, what? What is that? I said, no, don't worry, I won't bother you again.
Really? You just...
Yeah.
You give me your interpretation and it'll work, huh?
Yeah. Exactly. He's one of those who said, I do the cast, and I do the cast because I know you can play it, so don't come to me and bother me with your method questions. But in a very funny way. And, of course, it's Woody Allen, so of course you say, of course, Mr. Allen, whatever you want.
Actor Javier Bardem recorded in February. He earned an Oscar nomination for his performance in the film Beautiful. It's now out on DVD. The new film Bad Teacher centers on a woman who teaches children who would be too young to see this movie. It's an R-rated comedy starring Cameron Diaz as, well, a bad teacher. Directed by Jake Kasdan, it also stars Justin Timberlake and Jason Segel as an out-of-shape gym teacher. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Bad Teacher is a raunchy comedy about a conniving, alcoholic, druggy middle school teacher played by Cameron Diaz, who'll do anything to get the money to buy herself some bigger breasts so she can marry rich and not have to do the job at which she's, yes, bad. How bad is she? I won't give away specifics, but every scene is contrived to make you say, that is a bad teacher, much as another R-rated film about someone not living up to the responsibility of interacting with children, Bad Santa, made you say, that is a bad Santa. So the movie is one broad joke on the theme of how bad is she, repeated over and over, and most of the early reviews have complained about its coarseness and vulgarity. My response is easily stated. Get off your high horses. Bad Teacher made me laugh harder than anything this year outside Broadway's The Book of Mormon, which is filthier and still won the Tony. As Elizabeth Halsey, Cameron Diaz does not walk when she can sashay, and almost always in short, tight dresses and stiletto heels. She looks, frankly, used, dissipated, hungover, her makeup smeared, her wide mouth looking unusually lewd. She's wonderful. But then she's often wonderful, despite recent high-profile embarrassments like Night and Day opposite Tom Cruise, mugging it up and trying too hard to be funny. Diaz doesn't need to mug. Her great big features are gorgeous and clown-like at once. As Bad Teacher opens, Elizabeth is departing John Adams Middle School, where she's been teaching for a year without even learning the names of her students, a matter of crushing indifference to her given her coming marriage to a rich boy. Alas, he dumps her, or rather, his mother insists he dump her, for racking up staggering monthly credit card bills. So it's back to bad teaching. On her return to the school in the fall, Elizabeth comes face to face with her opposite number, played by the brilliant British actress Lucy Punch, often a sex pod in movies, but here the soul of primness.
There she is! Elizabeth Halsey! Woo! I am so excited we're going to be across the hall, mates, but I am so sad it's because your relationship ended.
Who are you again?
Amy Squirrel.
Squirrel?
Yeah, you know. Don't worry, you were kind of a lone wolf last year and so busy planning the wedding.
I found him in bed with somebody else.
Oh my gosh.
It was another man.
Shut the front door.
That lie about him being with a man, it evolves the more she tells it. You can imagine. Or maybe not. What Bad Teacher most reminds me of is old Bill Murray comedies like Stripes or Meatballs, but with a woman talking dirty and using everything in her arsenal to get what she wants, cheating, lying, and being incorrigibly sleazy and opportunistic in the great American degenerate movie huckster tradition. There's a Bill Murray figure here, too, a pudgy pothead gym teacher played by Jason Segel, who watches her with amusement, admiration, and unconcealed lust. One thing, though, as taken as he is by her gonzo ways, he doesn't collude in her bad teaching. He thinks she should do something else. Although Elizabeth isn't punished for breaking almost every law there is, ethical and legal, she's not rewarded either. Where she ends up is very satisfying, even touching. Director Jake Kasdan loves his actors and gives them room to breathe, and in some cases, hyperventilate, along with sterling turns by Diaz, Siegel, Lucy Punch, and Phyllis Smith from The Office as Elizabeth's mousy colleague. Justin Timberlake defies expectations as an insipid little bespectacled nerd with a fortune from his family's watch business, a performance of gentle weirdness that builds to a non-sex sex scene with some of the most inspired nerdy-dirty language I've ever heard. I've missed gonzo. I don't mean fake gonzo, like the Judd Apatow movies in which child men act out before they have to grow up, or swill like the Hangover films that reinforce American male's sense of entitlement. Bad Teacher, like Bad Santa, is blessedly free of redeeming social value.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.